No, I don't.
Was he prosecuted for it or anything like that?
I don't think he ever was.
Uh-huh.
He probably made restitution on his, Charlie did, I think.
Now, this was a different good bar than the one that you worked for.
Yes, that was, he was a brother to Charles.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
William.
William Goodbar.
Yeah.
Now, Ernie, I think people are interested in knowing how did, you say that there hadn't been any bank failures in Montgomery County, but you ever knew. Were there any runs on banks in the county?
No, not that I recall. I don't think there ever was a run on a bank.
When the bank moratorium came, what happened? Was there pretty much panic in the county over the banks?
Well, there was quite a bit of concern. But of course, that's the reason that they set up just 5% from their regular accounts. See, so some people could have some access to a small amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess another reason was to give them a little time to for things to get stabilized.
Mm-hmm. How long did the moratorium last?
If I remember right, it lasted 3 days.
Uh-huh.
Can you shut that off?
Yeah. All right, what were we talking about, Ernie? We got this old bank book out here now.
Yes. A neighbor of mine brought that in the other day, and we're going to put it, when I get through looking at it, which I guess I've looked it over pretty carefully, we're going to put it down the local library.
Uh-huh.
And that's a record of the minutes of the meetings. And I think you can see there that on that last page that the assets of Puddings are about $270,000.
Yeah, $279,000.
Yes.
In this small bank down here. Let's talk more about the bank moratorium. How did that go over in Montgomery County?
Well, as far as, of course there was some concern, but as far as I can remember, it didn't cause any panics or anything like that.
Did loans tighten up considerably then?
Yes. They tightened up quite a bit, and I think one thing that brought on the depression and the 29 and 30s was the fact that the bankers got scared, and I guess and the insurance companies, and if they had a loan with a farmer for a considerable amount, they told this borrower that had a farm loan on his farm that they wanted the loan, they called the loan right now. They wanted it.
Yes.
And now, under the present banking system, we wouldn't do that, or the banks wouldn't do that. If a farmer got into some difficulty, now we'd give him some time to work the situation out, see. And back then, that's what caused the depression and broke so many people, broke so many farmers. If you owned a bank, owed a bank a loan, and they all got scared, and they called a loan right now, we sent it, and it caused a lot of farmers to just completely lose their farm.
Yes. Now, did that happen here in the county?
Oh, yes. I don't know how many. I don't know how what percentage of...
Now, during the moratorium, where were you working? At the Crawfordville State Bank?
I was working at the... I was working at the Elston Bank.
At the Elston Bank?
Yeah.
Well, you started out in the State Bank.
Oh, yeah.
Well, tell us, you went from the State Bank over to the Elston Bank. When was that?
Well, I don't recall the date exactly. It was someplace probably between 25 and 30, probably.
What was your job over at the Elston?
I never was in the Elston.
Well, I thought you said you moved over there and you were at the Elston.
No, they bought the old state bank and moved over it.
Oh, I
in the Elston, and of course I was with the Elston, see.
Oh, and when did that happen? And when did they buy out the state bank?
It was about... What?
About 1930?
I think so, probably around 1930.
And you were in the bookkeeping department?
Yes.
All right, Herney, how long did you stay with the Elston then, or after it took over the state bank?
I stayed with the Elston until July the 21st, 1941.
And then where'd you go?
I came to Ladoga, to Ladoga State Bank.
And was that a new bank at the time?
Oh, no. No, it was a...
Whom did you succeed? Who had been down there?
Pence and Larrick.
Oh, Pence Larrick was down there.
Yeah, Pence and Larrick was down there, and after I came down there, I was, the board appointed me cashier, and he went to the Central National Bank at Greencastle.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked down there, I'd say probably a year, such a matter, and then he went from there to Darlington.
Yeah.
And he was there in Darlington at the time of his death.
Yeah. Now, what job, you went down as cashier at Ladoga then?
Yes.
And how long did you stay there as cashier?
I stayed there as cashier until 19... I don't recall how long I was cashier. I was cashier quite a while, and then the board, Frank E. Davis was president during the time I was cashier, and his health went bad on him, and he resigned, and that, and the board put me in as president. But that was, I don't know just what year it was, but I retired from the bank in 1969. Now, I noticed, I know what the, I think this is very interesting. Now, the controlling interest in our bank, when I came to Ladoga, was owned by the Central National Bank of Greencastle.
Hmm.
Fred O'Hare was his name.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of Fred O'Hare?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, his only interest in, he didn't cooperate with the community, and consequently the community didn't operate or cooperate with him. And I think what he used this bank for was to dump some of the bonds, railroad bonds that he was scared of and didn't want to hold any longer, up to this bank. Well, I remember the footings when I came to Ladoga, and the first statement I put out December the 31st, 1941, our footings was $270,000.
That was just about what they were in 1980.
Yeah, that's right, and our loans, they had $70,000 in loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the Department of Financial Institution to, Joe McCord was head of it at that time.
Yes.
I thought you probably know Joe.
I remember that.
You heard him of him. I said, Joe, I can't make any money on $70,000 worth of loans. I know the business is there. I'm going to loan some money to these farmers around there and businessmen. I may lose a little loan once in a while, but I can lose a little once in a while and make a darn sight more money than I can go along with $70,000 worth of loan. He said, I think you're right. He said, go back and go to it. He says, our department won't bother you, at least for a while. They won't even examine it.
So that's what you did you?
Yeah, I sure did.
And who'd you loan money to?
Everybody that needed it, that I thought was qualified for a loan.
Did you find that people were eager to borrow money from a local
sure
bank? Well, how'd you get rid of those bonds that Fred O'Hare dumped on you?
Well, we at that time we had the Reconstruction had some what they called debentures, held by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and we couldn't pay a dividend until we got rid of those. And I wrote to Reconstruction Finance Corporation and told them I wanted to get rid of it. That was about a year or two after I became cashier. And I said, I want to pay those debentures off. And they would write back wanting more information, the same old information that I'd given them two or three times before, only just in a different form. So I finally called Joe McCord up and I says, Joe, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation is playing horse with me on those debentures. They don't want them paid off. They don't want me to pay them off. He said, I tell you what you do. The next set of forms that you get from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, you fill them all out and don't you send them to the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. He said, after you get them completed, you send them direct to the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago with a draft for the amount you owe the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and tell them, write a letter with them, and also on your draft, payment of debentures held by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in full.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I did, and I never heard any more from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I don't quite understand that. You mean that you owe the Reconstruction Finance Corporation money, or they owe you money?
We owe them money.
You owe them money.
Yeah, well, that's the reason they didn't want to pay it off, you see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We owed them money during... and it was during those tough times during the Depression there when there was quite a few banks back at that time held had debentures, they called them debentures, held by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Yeah. All right. Now, I've got you at the Ladoga Bank now, and tell us about the history of the bank then after you got with the Ladoga, State Bank. You worked there as a cashier. What about the growth of the bank?
Well, I can tell you, as I told you before, when I came to Ladoga, the first statement I put out, our assets were $270,000. And when we merged with the First National Bank of Crawfordsville, our assets was over $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
That shows you that the business was here, and that if the bank would cooperate with the community, they would cooperate and boost the bank.
Well, now, how'd you get O'Hare out of here? What happened to him? Did he sell out to the local people or what?
No. They just reorganized. I mean, in fact, the local director, there was a gentleman by the name of Graybill and Fred O'Hare, and a gentleman by the name of Albin, I think. Bob Warner and Frank Davis and Herman Davis, they just got rid of Fred O'Hare, and in fact, what happened, they just reorganized a new bank.
Oh, then.
And they went around and sold stock to all the citizens around in Ladoga, and after they got enough stock sold, Charlie Travis, I don't suppose you ever knew Charlie Travis, he was a good friend of mine, ran the hardware down here. And he called me up on the phone one evening and said, we need a cashier for the bank down there. And he told me the situation. And I'd like for you to come down and talk to the board of directors. And I came down, talked to Frank Davis, and and Bob Warner, and Herman Davis, and I think Roy Stover was one of them, and so we finally got together, and I decided I didn't. I'm not criticizing him, but it's in, you know, in a lot of companies, and there's certain situations that I knew that I didn't have any future in the Elston Bank, and that I didn't have anything to lose by coming down here, which I'm tickled to death that I made that decision.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite see now whatever happened to O'Hare. How could they do that? You know, how could they take the bank away from them?
Well, I don't really know. All I know is they just, I suppose the board just disbanded or fired him or something because...
Well, he owned the stock, though, you said.
Well, they
bought the stock.
They bought the stock, yeah.
They bought him out.
Bought him out, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, now, you've told us that... the bank grew then probably tenfold in the time that you were there, more than tenfold.
Yeah, that's right.
What type of business were you doing? What was your main line of business, banking business? Farm?
All types. And that's one advantage of being head of a small bank. You get the whole picture. You handle farm loans, you handle personal loans, automobile loans, appliance loans. We handle the whole thing. In fact, later on we bought a lot of automobile paper, which is one of the best businesses you could have.
Speaking of farm loans, Ernie, in the time that you've been in the banking business, have you seen what big farmers were wiped out that you can recall, that you remember, by the banks? Can you remember any big farmers who were wiped out?
No, not in this area.
There were a considerable number of foreclosures, weren't there? In this area? Especially during the Depression?
Well, it might have been during the Depression. I can't recall her name, but then that was during the 29-30s along there.
Right. So,
of course, down here, I don't really... recall anybody losing their farms. Of course, there might have been some that insurance company foreclosed on, but they relented quite a bit on giving the farmers more time. Now, I might state this, which I'm proud of the record, and I'm proud of the community for it. I was here in from 1941 to 1969, and I made a lot of farm loans. In fact, I made some to the Prudential Insurance Company, and I made a lot of residential loans. On this property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I threatened and went through the legal procedure, and you probably handled that. I never had one foreclosure from 1949 to 1969, all the time I was in the bank.
Mm-hmm. Not one single foreclosure?
Not one single foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
I threatened one and posted notices on telephone poles around that it was going to sell him out a certain time, but when that time came, he come up with the money.
Uh-huh.
And from that time on, We had a loan with him for, he never even, we never had any more trouble with him.
Bank robberies at your bank?
How do you have,
and why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Well, the first one we had, I didn't know anything about it till it was all over.
When did it happen?
I don't know. I can't recall the date. I was holding a board meeting, and one of the customers. And I told you I'd ever had any foreclosures. Well, it wasn't a foreclosure, but I was going to. I went out and picked up 80 head of Holstein cows and all of these farmers' farm machinery and sold it.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't lose any money on it.
That was the one that, was that Chittick?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That was Chittick. I don't know where I was before.
You were going to tell about the bank robbery.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the first one. I'd been having a board meeting. It was concerning this Chittick. He'd applied for some additional credit, and of course we turned it down. We just got through, I had the door closed to the director's room because so that the customers couldn't hear what we was talking about. We all got up from the director's table, and I opened the door, and Eva was the front window. Eva Williamson.
Yeah.
And she said, "We just been robbed."
Oh boy.
They got him the next day, but his name was Persinger from Jamestown, and he'd been a marshal at Jamestown previous to that. The second one.
Well, now how did that happen? You say you were, Eva was held up. What happened? Did he come in and pull a gun on her, or what happened?
Yes, she was walked up the front window, and he pulled an automatic a gun of some kind. I think the FBI said it was a German make. And of course, he pointed the gun at her, and he said, "Give me the money in the drawer." And she opened the cash drawer, and she took out all the money, and I guess put a rubber bander on it and handed it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And she told him, she says, "Hey, you're crazy. She said, you get caught doing this." And of course, they did get him the next day.
Mm-hmm.
How'd
they catch him? Well, so quickly as that.
Well, I don't know.
Did somebody recognize him there at the bank?
No. And I think somebody tipped the FBI off.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get a home run. He went from here to Rochdale, and he loafed around down Rochdale. He had some relation down there, I think a brother-in-law or something, and he stayed down there all day, and it got real foggy that night, and then he drove home through the fog. But the FBI picked him up the next morning.
Well, did somebody pick up his license plate from his car or something like that?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
You see, the FBI and the Sheriff's Department, they don't tell you much how they got a hold of things.
All right, now you say you were robbed again.
Yes.
When was that? Tell us about that.
Edna, you remember the date?
Well, you don't have to give it.
I
just tell me about the circumstance.
Well, Lawrence was going to go on.
That's Lawrence Brown.
Lawrence Brown was going on vacation. The next week on Monday, and this was on Saturday. I mean, No, this is when I went down to the bank. But I had some things I wanted to talk over with Lawrence before he went on vacation, see. So I went back to the, I ordinarily went to lunch at 12 o'clock, but I came home and ate lunch early, and I went back about an hour early, didn't I? I went back just about 11 o'clock to confer with Lawrence, and I was sitting in the back office. Lawrence was on the other side of the desk, like you were sitting there, and I noticed Lawrence looked up, and he had a funny expression on his face. And I just turned around, my chair around, and looked, and this fellow by the name of Scott from Rochdale, he lived near Rochdale, came through that door with a gun on me.
Mm-hmm.
And he told Lawrence, he says, get on the floor, lay on the floor. And he went in, he says, you get out of the chair and go around it, in there. And he put both of the girls on the floor. That was Eva Williamson and Jesse Madsen. They were laying on the floor, and he told me to go in the vault. And he had a gun right in my bag. And so we call it the watermelon. It's one of these round Mosler safes, you know.
Yeah.
You've seen them. With a door on them about a foot thick. Well, that's where we kept the money. I had some hid in a lockbox, and that they didn't get that, but they cleaned us out on everything else. So he told me to reach in there and get in the money. So I reached down to the side of this, as we call the watermelon, and picked up a big money sack that we got currency shipped in from the Federal Reserve Bank. I expect it was, 18 inches, but pretty near 2 feet large then. Mm-hmm. And I reached in and got all the money and stuffed in that bag and handed it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had his gun in his right hand, holding my bag. He says, get it all. I said, I've got it all. He switched his gun from his right hand to his left hand, and then he got down and felt it all in that watermelon seed to see if I hadn't left any money in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then he herded me out where the others were, where Jesse and Eva was, and he says, you lay on the floor too.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fellow by the name of Dooley from Indianapolis. He was with him. And he stood up in my office, and one of the girls said something to the other or something, and he told him to shut up. But I'd always trained my employees, and I'd trained myself, if we ever got held up, to try to see what the hold up person had on, so you could give a good description of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I laid there and watched Scott go down the counter, and I, when the FBI called us to Indianapolis to, they had his clothes over there, this Scott. Why, I identified all his clothes, and he had on patent leather shoes. I know these shiny kinds, you know.
Yeah.
And so, he came up before Judge Steckler, and I think he gave him 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But he, after he held up the bank, he escaped out of the Marion County Jail, and he went to Chicago and held up a tavern up there, and he killed two men during the holdup. Well, the FBI and at that time, Clarence Demmert was sheriff, and the FBI and Clarence says, if you'd have made one false move, said, he wouldn't have had a safe to carry and shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a bad actor.
Mm-hmm. Did he go, is he still in the pen, or is he?
Oh, yeah, the judge at Chicago, and Clarence told me that he killed a policeman after that sometime in St. Louis. But this judge in Chicago gave him two consecutive 99-year sentences.
Oh.
So he's actually still in someplace. I don't know, I wouldn't.
Now, were any other bank robberies that you were involved in, Ernie, or is that the only
one? No, that's, and I don't want to be involved in any more.
All right. Say, now, I never have asked you about banking hours in those days, back in the early days when you first started banking. What kind of banking hours did they observe?
It depends an awful lot on whether you're off balance of an evening or not.
Yeah,
no, the ordinary banking hours was from 9 to 3.
And they were open on Saturdays, though, too.
Oh, yeah.
All day Saturday or just Saturday morning?
No, back when I was in the Elson, we was open all day Saturday. That was one of our big days.
Mm-hmm. And